Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msoucy@WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. The show is available on iTunes, and like all the podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. Well, it's old home week. Joining me in studio, yes, I'm trying to break out of my hermit shell, which we all are, really, is a fellow film critic, one-time substitute host, and just all-around good guy, Chris Lloyd. How are you, buddy?
Great to be here. It's been a minute. Everything around the WFYI building has changed, I think, since I've been in here the last time.
Except for me.
Except for
you. Although, and I still want it noted, his hair is still longer than mine for the time being.
Yes. For those who didn't see it back in December, I got it the chop on air on the television station.
That's where you're supposed to do it.
Yeah. And of course, we donated to Locks of Love.
Good.
For the record, my wife measured it the night before. I had 20 inches of hair.
So which blonde albino assassin is going to get your hair?
Presumably probably some sweet little kid.
Or Paul Bettany for a role.
Yeah. They had a thing where it's like you could like, in addition to donating your hair, you could donate money and they would like send you like pictures and the story of everything.
Oh, I see.
It was quite a lot of money though. It was like $500 or something. I was like, you know what?
Just to know where it's from.
For $500 you can have the hair and I'll have the mystery.
There you go. I had recently gotten haircut number 5 in the last 11 years.
Yeah.
So I know this is great. Podcast fodder, friends, go with it. When the kid was home from college, they liked to cut their parents' hair. And the kid noticed that I had probably about 4 inches of knotted hair, almost a dread. And as we all know from the 90s, dreadlocks on Caucasians, it's a bad look.
So they
cut them off. And because generally I tend to, you know, grow it out until I can donate it. And there's a friend of mine, my buddy Ella, who we did a show together many moons ago in Richmond, and they had just gotten their license and they got a chair, and I wanted to support them. Plus, I wanted to see how much black is still left. A little. I call it the pretty woman phase of the black and white hair, so the salt and pepper hair. So. So that's kind of where that was.
And that's always fun. I'm blessed. I only have a little bit of gray right around like the temples, but if I grow my beard out, it's like 100% silver now.
Nice.
I instantly look 20 years older.
You become grizzled old coot in the Western.
Yeah. I've considered like doing just the mustache if I could get like a true Sam Elliott.
Raleigh fingers. You gotta do the curl.
Yeah, if I could get like a real soup strainer, but mine's pretty scraggly as I recall, so yeah.
Yeah, Mrs. Soucy likes enough fingers to go through the hair and, the facial hair until I have to do it for a show. So we'll see. Anyway, welcome to the grooming portion of Film Sociology. That's what we do here. But last week, Chris and I got to see a film together in the theater in advance, thanks to the Heartland folks for letting us invade their little private screening of the new film from director Ben Affleck, who also has a supporting role in this. And it's the film Air, which tells the story of the origins of the Air Jordan sneaker. Now, it sounds like a sexy action plot, I know, but if you are a fan of, say, Moneyball or Apollo 13, the non-space portions of Apollo 13, where it's lots of dudes in business shirts discussing what to do next. You could do a lot worse than this.
Yeah. If you want another basketball story, it's never been turned into a movie, but a great basketball book, The Breaks of the Game by David Halberstam, which is like set in, like I think, the early 80s and around Portland with the Portland Trailblazers. And, of course, Nike was centered there around Portland. So there's a lot of stuff like, you know, Phil Knight and Sonny Vaccaro, who are the main characters in this movie, have a big role in that book. So if you've not read that book, you should.
And of course, those guys, Ben Affleck is playing Phil Knight, and Matt Damon is playing...
Sonny Vaccaro.
Not Brenda Vaccaro. This one, Matt Damon's allowed to eat in this one, as opposed to training for the Bourne films, which
yes.
is nice for him.
Yes, it's one of those movies where the movie star gets plumped up all the way to the point where they look like the average American male.
Wait a minute, I hear Ed Johnsonat from beyond whatever chiming in agreement. That was one of the things that bugged him to no end. I will say, I know when Christian Bale showed off his gut in American Hustle, Damon at least doesn't do that in this.
Yeah, he doesn't look... I do suspect that Damon is wearing some padding around the middle to accentuate it, but you can tell like from his face he definitely gained some weight for this role, and it is amazing how much different it makes him. And I don't know about you, I'm always fascinated by actors and actresses who are willing to make major alterations in their appearance, lose a bunch of weight, gain a bunch of weight, cut all their hair off, all that kind of stuff. I mean, to me, that's just fascinating because I love the chameleon aspect of acting.
Yes.
Plus, you know, that just takes guts. I mean, as an actor, I mean, your face, your body, that's your instrument, man.
Mm-hmm.
And you're mucking around with that, and that's...
That's why, eventually every actor knows they're going to have to stop.
Yeah.
De Niro, after doing not as much, I thought I heard he had to put on 40 for... The Untouchables,
yeah.
and he said he'd never do it again. So that's, you know, that was late 80s, and he was probably in his early 40s, maybe?
Yeah.
But there's that kind of thing where you just don't bounce back like you used to. Now, of course, before everybody gets into a tither, yes, you could hire somebody of that size and you know, good luck finding that. But I remember when I had to play Falstaff for a play, and this was 2019, and when I got the offer... I started thinking like that, and then I finally had to ask the director, am I going to have a suit? And I said, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, thank God. I was like, no, thank God.
Yeah.
No way. Because if it comes on, it's never coming off.
Yeah. I mean, so this is probably like Damon probably gained like 25 pounds.
Yeah.
And I would suspect that they hung some padding under his shirts just to kind of – there's a couple of scenes where like he's like sitting or bending over – just so you can get the droop effect, you
yeah.
know, really make it stick.
And he has enough money that he can hire a trainer to lose it when it's all said and done. So
yeah.
good on you, Matt.
And what's that drug that everyone in Hollywood is taking now? I can't
I
remember the name of
I
it.
I don't know what you're yeah. talking. Yeah, what a publicity
begins with an O. It's like it's a diabetes drug, and like all of Hollywood is taking it because it's like it helps you lose weight.
Olive oil. I don't know. I just anyway. So yeah, this is an underdog story because. The Nike division at this time that only was geared toward runners, and I think they had one basketball player, and they wanted to get into the bigs with a big name basketball player.
Yeah, two observations of the movie. Yes, it's a movie where the marketing guys are the heroes. We finally have our moment. For those who don't know, when I'm not wearing my film critic hat, I do work in marketing for a nonprofit healthcare company, and yes, it's like. The marketing guy is always like the Weasley guy who doesn't want to do any work and has no real talent.
Clint Howard.
Yeah, exactly. and also a movie in which Nike, which I don't know what their like market cap value is, but you know, many hundreds of billions of dollars are the underdogs.
They're the underdogs against yeah. Converse, those dreaded.
And Adidas.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's true. So at that time, they were the small dogs in the basketball shoe market. Everyone kind of had... All their basketball shoes kind of looked the same because the league had rules about you could only have a certain amount of color and design.
Yeah.
And Converse was the big players back then with those shoes with, like, absolutely no art support. I don't know how anybody wears wears those. I would get plantar fasciitis after 1 week of wearing those.
I don't know how to spell that, says the guy in the Chuck Taylor high tops. but, yeah, so there's that aspect of it. Because like, I believe like Magic and Bird already had contracts.
Yeah.
And so the question it was, and you get this great scene early on. If you are a sports fan, that also helps. It is a good underdog story, even if you make fun of the fact that they're billionaires. But if you're a sports fan, which both of us are, because we're of similar age and different tastes in sports, but still taste, there's a moment. Do you take the money and get you would traditionally get three or four players, or in what the Matt Damon character does, what Sonny Vaccaro wants to do, is push all of his chips in on one player who has not played a pro game yet, and that would be the kid from North Carolina.
Yeah, Michael Jordan, and not even the first pick, not even the second pick.
Sam Bowie and
Mel Turpin was number five or six, and Barkley was number five, I think.
Yep.
Charles Barkley. That's what I was wondering. It's like, you know, don't forget, the number one was Hakeem Olajuwon, then known as Hakeem, which still looks like a pretty darn good pick. Still a Hall of Famer, won two championships. They did okay with the number one pick.
They did okay. And Sam Bowie, again, who knew?
Who knew?
He fell apart after a few games.
It happens, including guys from right here in Indianapolis.
Hi, Greg. Yeah, it's kind of that.
Hi, Greg. We love it. Hey. Assistant coach at Butler really turned his life around.
He is.
If you didn't see a big, long article, I think it was at The Athletic, about him coming around. We love you, Greg.
Good on him. Very good. So, yeah, Hakeem Olajuwon, Sam Bowie, and then, yeah, Michael Jordan. So there's this great moment. So you see these names like Barkley and Stockton, and one that just makes me giggle is the fact that they all look at the board and go, where's Gonzaga?
Yeah, where's Gonzaga? Physically, where is it?
Yeah, because we just got through, friends, we just got through a tournament where every year it's, you know, you owe it to yourself if you're a sports enthusiast in any way. Find out where these tiny old schools or schools with weird names that don't have the state in them. Where are they?
Yeah. But, yeah, it really is. And just, you know, Damon plays the guy who's on the vision quest. It's, you know, he's the guy. He couldn't get a job anywhere else. He's almost going to be fired there. Nike is getting ready to just get out of the basketball, drop the basketball line of shoes, and just give up. And he sees one moment on a tape.
One shining moment.
One shot. And says, this is – and he just says, I know. And then he does the very unprecedented thing as he goes down against everyone's wishes, including – Chris Messina playing David Falk, the cutthroat agent of Jordan.
Everyone's favorite trope in sports, the D-bag sports agent that makes more money than all of us combined.
Yeah. And cheerfully soulless is how I put him in my review. But he goes down and sees the parents, Mr. and Mrs. Jordan, with Viola Davis playing Dolores Jordan, who's the real boss.
On Michael's assistance, in real life. Yeah. Michael Jordan wanted Viola Davis in the film and got it.
Yeah, so that was really good. And they have some really nice scenes together where, you know, she plays the woman who is used to being devalued her whole life, but she understands who her son is and what he was going to become and is willing to do this dance. And, yeah, she's got a really nice role. And also, Jason Bateman has a really nice soulful turn as the head of marketing, who, you know, usually Jason Bateman in supporting roles, he's there to make some quips.
Guys, hey guys.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm in charge of marketing here.
Yeah.
Hey, and there is that, but there's a little more depth to it.
Yeah, and he gets like two or three really good like monologue scenes where it's just him talking, talking about his life, you know, where he is, being a dad, you know. There were some moisture around the corners of my eyes. He was really good.
Chris Tucker also is in this as one of the guys.
First time in like 25 years I've seen a movie, Chris Tucker in a movie. I was like, wow, Chris Tucker.
Yeah, wait a minute. Silver Linings Playbook.
Okay.
So there's two. But yeah, he's at a normal volume. But also the other thing that we mentioned Ben Affleck, who is the director of this, and he comes off the bench as Phil Knight. And I talked about this the night of the screening. But I think He knows where he is, I guess, in his film career to a certain degree, to come off the bench and, you know, wear the silly wig and the glasses and think about his breathing as Phil Knight.
Yeah.
Just like he came off the bench in the – nobody saw it, but better than point in The Last Duel.
Yeah.
Playing this kind of foppish, over-the-top, indulgent life king. And also the fact that he's a good director. I think currently he is, of course, everyone's favorite meme of, you know, being outside with a cigarette and your eyes closed and just disgusted at the world, or bored silly at an awards party next to your wife. But when it comes to work, he's still working.
He's still
working well.
Yeah, and this is not a flashy movie. I mean, it's a talky movie. It's not a movie that, believe it or not, there's not a lot of basketball action in it. Jordan does not appear. There's a guy who plays Jordan, but we never see his
face. Which is a really smart, cute move.
Yeah, because you can't – who are you going to get to look like Jordan, seem like Jordan, have the weight of Jordan even as a 21-year-old? That's tough.
There's a number of great moments, like the camera stays on Viola Davis, and you can see her son behind him, her, you know, but and you can just see him from the neck down. Stuff like that, little camera tricks like that. So yeah, it's and kind of to a certain degree, even a film like Argo, which it, you know, is not a conventional action adventure film. Just like this isn't a conventional potboiler, but it does it well. It does the, it tells the story well.
Yeah, a great movie where you are in suspense, even though everyone knows exactly how everything turned out.
Although I think there are young folks, the mall crowd, who know there is a shoe, and that's really about it.
Yeah,
they don't know how deals get made or something like this. So it's not sitcom business. And it's not, I mean, I think it's a step above your typical business movie or movie business of how business deals are made. There is a great moment of Matt Damon delivering a wonderful monologue as a part of the pitch. He calls an audible and does this pitch, and he is given the support by Phil Knight and the flinging of a folder that doesn't go very far. And it's one of the great punctuations to a great scene and really broke up the house.
Yeah. So it's interesting. We have these, you know, sports movies have always been a thing, but now we're having the business of sports movies, you know, Moneyball, Draft Day.
Yep. Draft Day, that's another one, yeah.
I'm trying to remember, what was the one on Netflix, a bird something, Bird Above, I can't remember the name of it.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, and this fits nicely in there. Not a great movie, but I think a pretty good movie.
And I have to admit, one of my favorite Chris Lloyd moments happened at the end of the film.
Oh, yeah, where they say, because Jordan, generally concerned.
They do a where are they now with everybody, like what happened to him after the deal.
Yeah, and so, of course, Jordan, considered the greatest basketball player ever. And, yeah, I had to shout out the name of the real greatest basketball player of all time, of course, Wilt Chamberlain.
Yeah, that was good.
Jordan, I shot people when I give them my top 10 list, and I say Jordan is like a solid 4. Hey, great player, great player. So, better than Bill Russell? Don't think so.
Wilt, Russell.
Actually, Wilt, in different iterations. Sometimes I have Bill Russell number 2, sometimes Magic Johnson number 2, but then whoever's not number 2 is number 3. I generally go Oscar Robertson number 4. I'll probably put Jordan 4, Oscar Robertson 5. We can take it from there, but yeah.
Mine are the 04 Pistons. Hashtag that guy. So yeah, Error opens this week. No, it opens Wednesday, so it's already out. So,
yeah, we've actually got
a
couple of
out.
Movies opening on Wednesday this week. For what reason? I don't know, because it's Easter weekend? I don't know.
Yeah, because you don't want to interfere. Well, no, I think ABC already aired the Ten Commandments, so I guess we're safe from that.
I guess my kids are on spring break this week, but I think most school systems are done by now, so I don't know why movies are opening on Wednesday this week.
So they are, but... what else is opening this week?
Super Mario Brothers, the Mario Brothers movie.
Yeah, I saw the Saturday Night Live sketch of Mario Kart done by HBO. I think I'm good.
Yeah. Well,
Pedro Pascal is Mario.
As we record this, my boys and I are getting ready to set out tonight to go see it. So
your boys have gotten more TV time than I have.
Yeah. the boys are super excited around the Mario Brothers movie, to the point where we actually made our spring break travel plans.
Oh.
Because we were originally going to leave today, and they're like, no, but then we would miss the movie screening. So, no, we had to put it back a day. They were like, no, there's no way. And apparently my youngest, Cameron, apparently he is, like, going around telling everyone in his grade level, A, that I'm on TV, and that I see the big movies early.
Oh, no. Yeah. How old?
9.
Oh.
So, yeah, we're going to have
to. You're going to have to sit down and... pop culture Atticus Finch.
Yeah.
So my moment was when the kid went into show and tell. We had been watching Carol Burnett, the Carol Burnett Show, I should say, and they started their presentation with, "You all probably don't know who Carol Burnett is."
Yeah.
And then I said, "Honey, what about the teachers?" They went, "Oh." And I said, "Yeah, you can't be that kid."
Yeah.
Okay. So, good luck, Atticus. All right, you're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. we're just all over the place because I have Chris in studio. And by the way, I appreciate you delaying your vacation to spend time with me as well. So.
Absolutely.
I want to get to Dead People We Like because we never have time for Dead People We Don't Like. Ryuichi Sakamoto, actor and composer, and I should probably get Brian Hart's in to talk about some of his work. He won an Oscar along with David Byrne for The Last Emperor back in 1987. A slew of music credits, over 100 credits as a composer, but I also remember him. This is one I need to revisit. I'll plug your Blind Spots column in a little bit, but I'm also on revisiting stuff because of my age, but I do vaguely remember him as Yanoi, Y-O-N-O-I, Yanoi, in the 1983 film Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, also known as the David Bowie POW film. That's on Criterion. Also appeared in The Last Emperor, also appeared in Abel Ferrara's The New Rose Motel, but just just a fascinating look at film scores from Ryuichi. So salute to you, sir. I went back, and by the way, go to the AV Club. You can go or the filmyap.com. And a while back, you and Nick Rogers had a piece on cinema blind spots, and so I was revisiting that before you all were coming in. Before you were coming in, and I
so this is notable movies that you would think a film critic has seen that we have not.
It happens. We all have them. It happens. Should we give off the aura that we've seen everything? We haven't seen everything.
Well, there's so many movies, and there's so many movies coming out every year, and now we have streaming in addition to theatrical film and VOD. And I mean, you could watch, you know, 5 movies a day, every day for the rest of your life, not anything new, just catching up on old stuff, and you would still have only seen a small portion of all movies to be seen. So it happens.
I had somebody on Facebook last week bring up that dilemma, and basically I just said, look, watch what you want, enjoy what you watch, and know you're not going to see everything.
Yeah.
And just go with it.
Yeah, I kind of led my list with, these are actually Best Picture Oscar winners
that
I have not seen.
The early ones, I'm with you, like ones from the 30s and 40s are probably high up on my list.
There's some from the very, very earlys, Cavalcade, Cimarron, not the Glenn Ford early one.
I actually own Cimarron on DVD.
Oh, cool. See, I've been trying to run it down to where to find it.
Let me know and I'll bring it in.
Cool. The Broadway Melody and Great Ziegfeld. So those are all like late 20s, early 30s, first years that they gave out the Oscars. But some pretty notable ones. John Ford's How Green Was My Valley.
Oh, I love that.
Mrs. Miniver.
I have
Going
that.
My Way. Gigi and Tom Jones.
Wow.
I've never seen Tom Jones.
There you go. Well, and part of it is that. The other part of it is when we try to get to something on that list, Kino Lorber brings us a box of stuff. You're like,
Yes.
I know these are first world problems, friends, but
definitely,
this is what we go through. But one of the titles you both brought up was The Sound of Music. I ask you, when you get a chance, there was a great piece, it was probably a month ago, on This American Life, the NPR show. And there's a great piece. It was for their 20th anniversary, but it's the story of one of the producers told the story that they grew up watching The Sound of Music, and they only watched taped one. And I talked about this because it was one of those double cassettes. And so I tried to ask listeners, what do you remember about where does the film split on a double cassette? Mm. Well, on The Sound of Music, the couple fall in love. Professor Von Trapp and Maria fall in love. And then there's the teenage girl and who she refers to as the mailman. Because Act Two gets into heavy Nazi stuff.
Yes.
And he's not a mailman. Well, he is a mail messenger, but it's for the Nazi party.
Yes.
And it gets very serious.
Yes.
And less singy. And so the producer and the subject, the producer and the one recording the piece, they watched the entire film together. And it was quite the opening experience.
My story on The Sound of Music is I hadn't seen it. I tried to watch it about maybe 12 or 15 years ago. And for whatever reason, I got like 15 minutes in, 20 minutes in, and I just turned it off, and it just wasn't working for me. And, you know, it's a very long film. And for whatever reason, I just said, okay, I'm not doing this. And then I only finally just watched it maybe like 6, maybe 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what was wrong with me the first time, but I absolutely enjoyed it thoroughly. It's one of those movies that's like, it has this amazing reputation that you think it can't possibly meet it, but then you watch it and it actually does meet it. Probably one of the other ones that's like that is, and of course now I'm blanking on the title, De Niro, I Could Have Been a Contender.
Raging Bull?
No, I
on the waterfront.
Robert
De Niro was not on the waterfront.
No, not the
Marlon
De Niro.
Brando. Marlon Brando.
Thank you, Brando. I'm getting my
your boxing films mixed up.
My boxing films mixed up. But yeah, that was one of those ones where it's like, there's no way this movie can be as good as they say it is. Then you watch it and you're like, wow.
I saw that in high school, and I got to see it at the IMAX. When Heartland had it, Carl Malden was here for that. That was very cool. Yeah, that was very nice.
Malden had one of the all-time great film acting careers, especially when you consider a guy who basically, had a face like a canned ham.
Hey. Don't be careful with your American Express card. And a Quinn Martin production. And Mitch. He played Mitch in Streetcar. And that's another one I know that was brought up, and I was thinking of you guys because I got to see a stage version of Streetcar. My buddy Casey Ross directed that, and of course last year I directed A Midsummer Night's Dream, set it in Athens, Louisiana. So when we get to the play within the play of Pyramus and Thisbe, I have Pyramus as Stanley Kowalski and Thisbe as Blanche DuBois. So I got to incorporate Tennessee Williams and Shakespeare. These are your pledged dollars.
Yeah,
work,
but yeah, friend. You can see on my phone here. So this is what I call my reeling backward list. So these are movies that I want to get to, and I don't know how many it is, but 50, at least 50 there.
I want to get to that in a second. Another one I wrote on me was non-epic David Lean is on my, like, Summertime I need to revisit. I think I've seen bits and pieces of that.
Never seen it.
Everyone's favorite cinematic spinster, Katharine Hepburn, in Venice in the 50s, and then all the stuff before that, everything basically before Lawrence of Arabia, I believe. So like Oliver Twist, but God, I was watching Oliver Twist again. So all the small studio stuff, and probably a lot of the early Hitchcock as well is one I need to get.
Yeah, there's some holes in my early Hitchcock as well.
So this week on the Reeling Back, you did Empire of the Sun, and this is a film, another one that I need to revisit. But in my case, it's a case of bad timing. But anyway, the floor is yours about Empire of the Sun.
So Empire of the Sun is my favorite Steven Spielberg movie, and it is not also coincidentally the one movie of Steven Spielberg's illustrious career that most people have never heard of, because it did not do particularly well at the box office. It kind of came and went in theaters in 1987, and it's kind of just stuck in there in between, like, his, 70s and 80s stuff. And then, like, and he kind of really came back big in the 90s with, like, Jurassic Park and Schindler's List.
Yeah, this was the follow-up to The Color Purple.
Yeah,
that's tough.
Always is, I think, the film he made after this. So mm-hmm. it was not, like, a bright spot in his career. And I've always just absolutely loved the film. And also to say, it's my favorite Steven Spielberg movie. I won't claim that it's his best movie.
But it's your favorite one.
It's my favorite.
That's like Paul Newman in Slapshot.
Yeah.
It's not his best work, but it's my favorite.
Yeah, exactly. And you to me, it's like the difference between, there are some movies that you see that I can acknowledge is a great, great, great film, but it doesn't personally move me. Citizen Kane is the classic example. I mean, I can sit there and watch it and understand its genius and its brilliance, but I don't get emotionally transported by that film in a way that I do like Empire of the Sun.
And as when you have kids, you'll learn, if you haven't already, just if you want to share with them a certain filmmaker, their best work may not be the best place to start.
Right.
Like, my kid's first Scorsese film was Hugo. My kid's first Woody Allen film was Midnight in Paris. That's just kind of got to read the room a little bit.
Yeah, but Empire of the Sun, mostly known probably today because it was Christian Bale's, I think, his first film role, or at least his first starring film role, when he was just like 13 years old or whatever he was, based on the J.G. Ballard book, which I've read the book. I enjoy the movie a lot more than the book. The book is like, it's a mix of nonfiction and fiction and, dreamlike hallucination. It's like his story of what happened to him as a kid, but with all sorts of filigree and imagination heaped on top of it. It's not a particularly easy to read book. So it's curious that Spielberg said, like, this, I got to turn this into a movie.
It helps you have Tom Stoppard doing the screenplay.
Yes, it does. But just, you know, it's a story of a British boy who is living. He's grown up in China. He's never he's British, but he's never been to Great Britain. And his parents are, you know, taipans, you know, Western business folk. And so they get trapped there during the breakout of the war. He gets separated from his parents and basically spends the entire war in prisoner of war camps. And he kind of has two father figures, really three father figures, but the main one being John Malkovich, who's this, like, very amoral American scrapper, thief, whatever you want to call him. He just sort of gloms onto him. And it's just such an amazing movie. It's very much about not just the war and what happened, but it's about, like, being 12 to 14, 15 years old, trying to find your place in the world, mm-hmm. that thing where you're like incredibly wanting of your own independence and to be grown up, but at the same time you feel that pull of wanting family connections and love and
especially
everything.
Especially
when a war breaks out. And yeah, so many great actors. I can't pronounce his last name. Pataglino is in
Joey Pants. Yeah,
Miranda Richardson is in it. Yeah, just a terrific cast, terrific movie, and I love it so much.
All right, well, so that's one I need to revisit because timing. Like I said, I didn't see it when it came in theaters. I did wind up renting it. What didn't help the film, and again, it's not the film's fault, not my fault. It just happened, but. Soon after this came out, because this was a Christmas Day release, because they dropped it at the end of the year for award consideration. It did get a few technical awards. But I wound up seeing John Borman's Hope and Glory first.
Oh, gosh, I love that movie.
Right? That's
very similar.
Yeah, that's
ways.
A Best Picture winner. And it's basically British children in London during World War One. So yeah. During World War II, I should say. So, yes, there are bombings of houses, but it's new treasure for them to find and new adventures and coming of age, and yes, you're still playful, but there's still a war going on, and that's another one that should be, I think, revisited. So I blame my 17-year-old knucklehead self that I'm like, well, I want to see something about a 12-year-old boy, but I knew John Borman's name because I was a fan of Deliverance, and he had already done Zardoz and Point Blank and Hell in the Pacific, but. I looked at thanks to Box Office Mojo, for December of 1987, when it came for just the box office results for the month of December. And as I mentioned, it says here the release date for Empire was December 11th. Sorry. But here, and it's on this list, number 13. Here are the 12 films that made more money than Empire of the Sun in 1987. Number one, Three Men and a Baby. Yeah, I saw that in the theater. Number two, Throw Mama from the Train.
Yep.
Saw it in the theater. Number three, Eddie Murphy Raw. Definitely saw it in the theater. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Another favorite.
Yep. Number five, Wall Street.
Yep.
Six, Fatal Attraction.
Wow.
Seven, the re-release of Walt Disney's Cinderella, for you kids out there. Number eight, Batteries Not Included, which... That kind of surprises me.
Yeah.
Number nine, Nuts, the courtroom drama with Barbara Streisand and Richard Dreyfuss, directed by Martin Ritt. Number 10, and if I had my way, this film would make a bajillion dollars, Broadcast News.
Oh, God.
One of the greatest romantic comedies of any decade and one of the best films of the
80s. It's multiple one of the greatest. It's one of the greatest movies of the 80s. It's one of the greatest romantic comedies. It's one of the best journalism movies.
Yep, big time.
Yeah.
Number 11, The Running Man. Number 12, Overboard. Then Empire of the Sun, number 13. So there's that aspect.
There's like three or four legitimate classics, you know,
right?
All-time classics in that
and
list.
And yes, we're talking about Broadcast News. It's not my fault you haven't seen it.
Yeah.
It's gotten the Criterion treatment. By the way, all of Albert Brooks's films should get the Criterion treatment, which I will get to in a second. I had a moment Oscar weekend. So we were up seeing the kid. And this is something, if I had a regular column, I would probably do this. But I revisited a film that just – it was just bad timing for me when it came out. And I watched it from – I was able to watch it from the very beginning, and it just resonated with me. Stand By Me.
You didn't like it the first time you saw it?
I was 16 and a cinematic D-bag.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Because
it was about 12-year-old boys. And
yeah.
You're like,
why do I want to see
baby these stuff?
Yep. Exactly. Exactly. And I was like, God, I have no interest in this whatsoever. I'm going to this R-rated movie.
Yeah. I watched that last, or I showed that to my kids last year. They loved it. I'd forgotten about all the bad language in it.
It's not bad.
It's pretty.
All right, I will say this.
Worse than I thought it was.
I think rape, Holocaust, and genocide are worse than those words that are in the film.
I'll agree, but you know.
But yeah, but if, this is why we don't rate plays, films. The film rating system flawed enough as it is.
That was one of the first movies where I've been trying to introduce them to some adult films.
Grown up. What have I been saying all these years? Grown ups.
Films for adults.
Jeez.
Grown up films. And I'll admit, you know, there's still some like super, super scary, demonic gore that they're not ready
for.
All
right, that's okay.
They're not ready for it.
That's all right.
SEX stuff, they're still not ready for it.
You can say sex here on Film Sociology.
I know, but like one of the ones we showed them was the first two Mad Max movies, so Mad Max and the Road
Warrior. Wow.
They're okay on violence, some, you know, language. But like, there's a like 2 second shot of like a topless woman in Road Warrior,
and that was the deal breaker.
Of course, they get all like giggly and so yeah, they're not quite ready for that stuff.
So yeah, I watched it. I'm like, God, yeah, these four kids are really good, and it was a reminder. River Phoenix, one of the great showbiz what could have beens.
Yeah.
And by the way, watch Running on Empty. That's another.
Yeah.
Most Sidney Lumet films should also get the Criterion treatment.
Yeah.
So put that on there. But yeah, I really and say what I. The only thing I really remember besides the feelings and Kiefer Sutherland growing his hair out for the Lost Boys was the train. The scene with the train still holds up. I remember seeing it being reviewed by Siskel and Ebert when it opened, and I went, "Yeah, that's pretty effective." So yeah. I think if you were gonna do a top 10, I think of scenes directed by Rob Reiner, that would be on there.
Yeah, and I was in a Facebook thread not too long, or actually I think it was just yesterday, where people were talking about like you know. Director decades, like they have a decade that's just like, wow, can you believe all the movies they made in that decade?
And then I was pointing out, fell off the planet.
Yeah, but like Rob Reiner's decade starting in 1984 with This Is Spinal Tap.
Sure Thing, Stand By Me. Wow. When Harry Met Sally. Hold on, I know this.
The Princess Bride.
Princess Bride.
A Few Good Men.
Yeah.
And there's one other one in there. But yeah, he had like it was like him and John, John Ford. Scorsese's. He's had a couple of those.
Yeah.
Who else am I thinking? Yeah, I mentioned John Ford, the Godfather director.
Coppola.
Coppola's decade from like 68 or 69 to 79.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
It's where they have like a decade where you just can't believe they made all those movies in one decade.
I'll tell you another one with that. It took me a while to take a shine to, and this is, again, not the film's fault. I saw The Princess Bride on a crappy double date.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. It was I'm 17. It was the moving the pinky over to do reconnaissance work and see, is this date going to hold my hand? No.
No.
So then my brain just went, okay, focus in on the film. And the film's good. The film's really good. But my date was dropped off early, and I had to stay in the car.
But that's that color thing.
If
that's your worst date fail, though, that's really not that bad.
Yeah, but I had to wait in the car for over an hour.
Oh, boy.
Waiting for my buddy to get finished.
Yeah. Boy.
So, sorry, Princess Bride. But it took me a few years. And then finally, it was probably a good 4 or 5 years before I finally rented it and I was able to wash over my soul.
Yeah, that's a great one. Speaking of date fails, no, I can definitely top that. I had one, Washington, D.C. I'm doing an internship and I went on a couple of dates with a woman from, I can't remember at the time, he was like a senator from Virginia. Was it Warner? I can't remember.
Dean Warmer?
No, it was like the, but yeah.
Yeah.
But I thought it was going pretty. I went for the kiss and she did the pullback. Full pullback. Yeah.
What was the film?
Oh, I don't remember. But so this would have been 94. So this would have been yeah, so like winter and spring of 94.
Shawshank. Or the specialist.
Yeah. But hey, I got to attend a State of the Union address.
How'd that go?
Pretty fun, actually.
Did you have
to
stand up every time he finished a sentence?
No, the press sits in a directly above where the speaker's lectern is.
Okay.
So they don't stand, they don't do anything.
Oh, good. It's not like mass.
I was, well, this is bad, maybe I shouldn't say this. I was amazed at the time how lax the security was. Like
back
I had,
then.
I had my press badge that was, issued. But that was pretty much it. It was just walk in, they didn't, no one scanned you, no one. And I was thinking, I was in the first row, and Al Gore, of course, as the vice president, was the president of the Senate, and he was sitting directly below me. And I'm sitting there tapping my pencil, and I suddenly realized, if I, with
drop
my fidgety
something?
Fingers, if I lost my
that's
pencil,
a felony.
It could have fallen and hit the vice president.
You could have assaulted the vice president.
Yeah, really.
It's a good thing you didn't. So.
Good thing.
But yeah, but that's 94. That's just, 9/11 changed everything when it came to security.
Well, and hopefully some more changes in the last couple of years, too.
Fingers crossed on that. Okay, one other title, I mentioned him earlier. So in my household... If I can get my wife, Lynn, the one who lets me call her Mrs. Sosi, I've learned she's always working on the laptop. So even if it's like, you can be there without being there. So I'm just like, honey, what would you like to listen to tonight? I learned a lot of the films that I need to watch that I've either purchased or been sent or what have you. And the last time I did this, I was like, oh, I need to watch that. We revisited Roman Polanski's Carnage.
Oof.
Yeah. Well, because I'm not going to show her any of the action nonsense or my cult films or all the heavy intense foreign stuff. But I'm like, we all saw this. The three of us like this. And then I was like, yeah, four very loathsome people, but it's well written.
Oh.
So I was like, okay, honey, I'm going to try to do better. So this week. Our date night, and again, if there's a great moment that makes my lovely wife look up from the laptop, that's always a plus. But a Criterion title, Albert Brooks's Defending Your Life.
Oh, that's a really underrated movie.
Really does, and it follows Lost in America. I had forgotten. With Albert Brooks as a filmmaker, he kind of goes from studio to studio, and it always bewilders the press and or the board, and they don't know what to do with his films, and they don't make $100 kajillion, so he has to go somewhere else. He got to do two films in a row at Warner Brothers / Geffen with Lost in America, and then he followed up with Defending Your Life.
I will say, Defending the Life contains the moment, the hardest I have ever laughed in a movie, ever.
Shirley MacLaine?
No, it was. I can tell you if you want, but because I don't want to ruin it. If anybody has seen the movie, is where they're at dinner and he's got like the very fastidious waiter.
Yes,
and he's talking.
Yep.
And it's hard to describe on the air, but like the more days that you have doing the interviews where they go over your life, it basically means you're more problematic.
Yes,
and less chance of being successful and being going back and all this kind of stuff. So the waiter's doing banter with him. He's talking to the Meryl Streep character. How many days do you have? She's like, two or whatever it is. And he's like, oh, that's nice. I'm going to bring you 3 pounds of pasta because you don't get fat in heaven.
Yes.
And then he turns to the Albert Brooks character and he said, whatever it is, like some like 7 days.
Nine,
like,
actually.
Nine. And the guy just stops and goes, ooh. Just like that. just stops, looks at him and goes, ooh. I was watching this. I was lying on the ground. With my parents, we were watching it on like HBO or whatever. I swear to you, I laughed for 10 minutes solid. I missed the next 10 minutes because I couldn't. That was it. It was the funniest moment in a movie I've ever seen, or at least I'll say the most I've ever laughed at a movie.
So yeah, it's So in this, he is a businessman. Kind of looks like his Lost in America character, who winds up dying in a freak accident and is in heaven. And it's not heaven.
Waypoint.
Yeah, basically limbo, what have you. I forget the name of the city, even though it's pushed like an American generic city. But it's not heaven and it's not hell. But he does have to present his case for existence.
Yes.
And his lawyer is played by the great Rip Torn, which I believe this was his first or at least first major ability to, we got to see him do comedy in this. So if you like, if you're a fan of Larry Sanders and Dodgeball, you can thank Albert Brooks for doing this. He's up against a defense lawyer played by Lee Grant. Meryl Streep shows up as the manic pixie dead girl. And she also gets to do comedy because she wasn't doing a whole lot of comedies at that time. But it's a really funny, non-religious look at the afterlife because it is something we all do. We're all going to die. And how does one handle that? And it really does it well in this one.
And you get lawyers.
And you have, yes, lawyers, yes. So only 8 films Brooks has done as a director.
Yeah.
Only 8. Real Life, which... revisit that. If you've watched any reality TV, and not just the stuff that PBS did in the 70s, check that out. Modern Romance, the anti-romantic comedy, which I might – that's one I need to revisit. Lost in America, which has the Criterion treatment, Defending Your Life, Mother. I took Lynn to see Mother when we were dating. Great performance by Debbie Reynolds. The Muse – not bad. Yeah. And Looking for Comedy in the Muslim World, also not bad. So, but for 8 films, pretty good. But yeah, give this man some more work.
Speaking of blind spots.
Yes, sir.
Never seen Lost in America.
Really?
Yeah.
There you go. Yep. So
I'm adding it to my list right here as we speak.
And the great thing with Brooks, God, because, and this kind of goes back to what we were saying earlier about as an actor, because he's obviously worked a lot more. 40 credits? That's it? Man, you know, it's interesting that there is the folks who know him because he put out comedy albums in the early 70s. He did the short films for Saturday Night Live when that series first started, and then started getting into films. He has a small part in Taxi Driver. I forgot he was in Private Benjamin, and then started doing these films that he appeared in terms of Endearment, Unfaithfully Yours, and then Broadcast News is the pinnacle. He got a Best Supporting Actor nomination. Oh wow, Sean Connery would slap you in the face if he saw if he heard that.
I wish we could have multiple winners that year. Ties.
That's pretty good. The non-musical I'll Do Anything. Someday James L. Brooks will release the musical clips of that film. Critical Care. But yeah, just and now because he's older and he doesn't look like the dark-haired, curly-haired neurotic, he's been able to do films like Drive and This Is 40 and A Most Violent Year. I forgot he's really good in A Most Violent Year. So,
things, and you would not think that a funny guy like that could do like Drive, do like villainous roles. What I love about his performance in Drive is it's like all the things that make him funny are still there, and he just kind of gives this quarter turn towards the malevolent.
Yep.
You know, and it's just like you could see how that guy could still be considered funny, but yeah. And just to defend myself on Sean Connery, that's a classic example of getting the Oscar for what was not his best performance. It was like Paul Newman with Color of Money. Would anybody say Color of Money was Paul Newman's best performance?
No, but it is not.
That's the one he won the Oscar
for. No, he did. And now that you mention that, I'm gonna counter that because I love The Color of Money unabashedly, not just because it's a sequel, but the other. Oh God, am I gonna get this? Am I gonna be able to do this quick? Probably not. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Okay, here's your nominees that year. Paul Newman won, of course, Color of Money. If I was voting, probably Dexter Gordon for Round Midnight.
Mm.
Love that film. I believe there's a yap about that.
I'm not sure about that.
I thought I sent you one. I thought I wrote about it. Oh, well.
Yep.
Anyway, no, I did. Like, William Hurt, Children of a Lesser God.
Oh, yeah.
Bob Hoskins, Mona Lisa. That's one I need to revisit. Mm-hmm. The great Neil Jordan. And James Woods for Salvador. Yeah. Okay.
Good year. Not a year where you say that's obviously the person who should win.
Okay. Well, there you go. So that's what we got going on. What else is happening over at the Yap besides a little of this, a little of that?
A little of that. right now I'm getting set for Indie Film Fest. That's coming up here as people will hear this. That'll be just a couple of weeks out from then. So pleased to be serving on a jury again this year. I think I've got like a 10 or 12 year run on their jury. So.
I think so. Now, are you going to be able to judge it on vacation?
I don't know. I've already burned through most of the shorts, so I'm going to try and finish up the shorts tonight.
Okay.
And then I've got the features to start on. So I've got a couple of weeks, but doing that. We are doing a lot of giveaways these days.
Good for you. That means they're sending you stuff.
They are sending me stuff. They deem us worthy. For those who don't know, a couple of years ago now, we switched from our old website, www.thefilmyap.com. And the only reason we had it called it The is because someone had taken filmyap.com and was squatting on it. Still is, as far as I know. And we've switched over to Substack. So it's just filmyap.substack.com. It's the same thing. You can go watch it as or enjoy it as a website, but it's also a newsletter. So you just sign on it whenever you're on the website, hit that subscribe button. It's free. You get all of our stuff. The moment we publish it, you get it in your email inbox. If you prefer and you like supporting folks, you can subscribe for a premium subscription. It's not a lot of money. Like, if you buy a movie ticket and a popcorn, you're already paying more than what you would pay for a year of subscription. And if you do that, you become eligible for ticket giveaways for all these preview shows, Blu-rays, 4Ks. We're giving away stuff all the time. And right now, the people who are our premium subscribers are very happy because, like, they're all in the rotation and getting stuff all the time. But you could be one of those people, too.
See, the Film Yap is made possible by your readership and by...
Yes, we do not have paywalls. All of our content is free to read.
This is the pledge portion of the show
this
right here.
This is the pledge portion of the show. And, hey, make your pledges because we all see what happens when you don't. But
in our case,
we're going to be there come rain or shine. But, yeah, support it. And something I like to say, the Film Yap is not just me. We have about 12... contributors, including Mr. Sosi himself.
In his cave.
Yes.
Mine, if you've ever seen the cartoon Shoo, that's my desk.
Yes.
Big rollover desk, and occasionally I come out of the cave and with my dialysis. And
we appreciate it when you let the sunshine shine on you.
Thank you. Oh, thank you.
But all the subscription money that we make, I give to our contributors. I don't take any for myself, and I'm proud to say that.
He is correct on that one. He is correct. So, all right, filmyap.substack.com. Chris, enjoy your vacation.
I will.
You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. We will go around the horn, and then we'll grab a pencil. There is one more dead person we like because we, of course, never have time for dead people we don't like. Director of photography, cinematographer Bill Butler passed away. I guess he's a few days shy of his 102nd birthday. And if you go through his work, it's an impressive and wide variety of work. But he received one Academy Award nomination along with Haskell Wexler for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest back in 1975. Credits go back to the early 60s and such noted and unnoted films like Fearless Frank from 1967, The Rain People, one of Coppola's early films, Drive, He Said, The Return of Count Yorga, that's on a double disc somewhere. Melinda, Hickey and Boggs, Running Wild, The Conversation. That's again working with Coppola on that one. Was also the director of photography on Jaws. So he helped scare me in my early childhood and get me a love of film. So thank you for that. And, of course, the great reaction shot of Roy Scheider on the beach there. Alex and the Gypsy, Lipstick, ooh, boy, that's rough, Demon Seed, Capricorn 1, which I remember seeing in the theater with my dad, Damien Omen 2, Grease, Ice Castles, Rocky 2, Death, oh my God, he did Can't Stop the Music, It's My Turn, The Lights Went Out in Georgia, Stripes, Rocky 3, The Sting 2, sometimes work is work, friends, the 1984 television version of A Streetcar Named Desire. That's for you, Casey. Beer, Rocky IV, Big Trouble, Biloxi Blues, The First Child's Play, Graffiti Bridge. It's amazing where the work takes you. Sniper, Cop and a Half, Beethoven's Second, Anaconda. Whew. The TV movie Hendrix, which had no music from Jimi Hendrix in it. Last credit is from 2016, The Boys at the Bar, but, so salute to Bill Butler. That's very impressive. So And yeah, along with one nomination. And Jaws. Let's never forget that. All right, let's go around the horn over at the Tibbs Drive-In this weekend. On Screen 1, Super Mario Brothers and Champions. Screen 2, John Wick, ooh boy, and Cocaine Bear. That's a long evening. Air and Creed 3. Okay. And then on Screen 4, Dungeons & Dragons and Scream 6 over at the Tibbs. At the Skyline this weekend, Super Mario Brothers and Champions. Over at IU Cinema, 7 o'clock, Friday, April 7th, from 1970, as part of the series Radical Acts, the cinema of Stephanie Rothman, The Student Nurses. And then at 10 o'clock from 1971, The Velvet Vampire. Saturday, April 8th, 4 o'clock, the kick to the chest that is Close from last year. Saturday, April 8th at 7 o'clock from 1968, Memories of Underdevelopment. Tuesday, April 11th at 7 p.m., Nicholas Roeg's Walkabout. Hi, Jenny. Wednesday, April 12th at 3 p.m., I Dared to Make a Film, a tribute to the life and work of Safi Fay. Thursday, April 13th at 7 p.m., Rafiki and Pumzi from 2018 and 2009. Friday, April 14th at 7 p.m., Drunk Town's Finest. Saturday, April 15th at 4 p.m., Pure Grit. And then Saturday, April 15th at 7 p.m., Gone with the River. All of that is happening at the IU Cinema. Of course, storm damage hit the Artcraft Theater in Franklin, so they have canceled the Glenn Miller story. According to their website, they're still going to have the Glenn Miller Orchestra on Thursday, April 13th. So two shows at 3 and 7 p.m. Friday and Saturday, 2 and 7:30 p.m., April 21st and 22nd, Spirited Away. And then Sunday, April 23rd at 2 p.m., the documentary Kiss the Ground. And Friday, April 28th, You've Got Mail. All of that is happening at the Historic Artcraft Theater in Franklin. All right, let's grab a pencil. Let's find out what you've been watching this week. Hopefully you got to watch some good films that are new, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. Oh, I see my buddy Jack's name up there. That also reminds me. This week, You Must Remember This. They are back in with their new series of erotic 90s, and this week was Pretty Woman and the Rise and Dip of the 90s career of Julia Roberts. So I got to see Pretty Woman in the theater. And then my hair is in Richard Gere mode at the moment. And then to coincide with erotic 90s, the guys over at Golden Globus are doing sex thrillers, and they started this week with Brian De Palma's Body Double. So that was fun to revisit that film with those guys. I'm not a guest, just revisiting the film as a memory. Next week, they are doing Joel Schumacher's 8mm. I hope they check out that film's father, better known as Paul Schaefer's Hardcore. Anyway, Jack, who's a regular at the GGT, Jack writes, the new Dungeons & Dragons movie was surprisingly and thankfully entertaining. I've been waiting 30 years for a good D&D movie, and they finally delivered. Congratulations, Jack. I'm glad you got that. Very cool. We go to Facebook, and we start with Patty, who writes Galaxy Quest. Yes, what a savings. Abby writes Rogue One, and it broke my heart. Jamie chimes in, I was so mad when my husband convinced me to watch Rogue One. Why encourage me for distress? Wow. Also, Jamie writes Pirates of the Caribbean, Curse of the Black Pearl, Dead Man's Chest, as well as The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. Lou Harry writes Sensations in 1945 has to be seen to be believed, as well as Tetris and Schmigadoon, also known as Schmicago. Abby writes Talladega Nights and Orgasmo. I needed some dumb humor this week. We all do. Abby, that's really okay. That is absolutely fine. Samantha writes Creed and Creed 2. Somebody's getting ready to watch the third one. Doug writes Sherlock Jr., Night Nurse, The Ten Commandments, The Paper Chase, Cinema Finds Its Voice, Fiddler's Journey to the Big Screen, Top Hat, Easter Parade, Young, Rich, and Pretty, and Earth Girls Are Easy. Nice. And some correspondence there. Nancy writes, Tetris with a crazy story. Definitely a must watch. Guy writes, tried watching the 2021 Candyman, but only made it circa halfway through. There you go. Roger writes, Red Planet, two thumbs down. Now you got to give Siskel and Ebert money. L.A. Confidential, always enjoyable. The Dark Past with William Holden and Lee J. Cobb, good but not delicious. Okay, title of my memoir. Finally, The Pelican Brief, excellent. Michelle writes, The Road. Dee Dee, drinks with Dee Dee Servino, writes 42nd Street. Jessica writes, Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom. Craig writes The Mutations, a.k.a. The Freak Maker, UK title, with Tom Baker and Donald Pleasance. There's a pairing. Thank you, Craig. Melissa writes Air and Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris. Amanda, of course, goes to the library. The Tomorrow Man, that's the one with John Lithgow and Blythe Danner. Drowning Mona, A Little Romance for you young, young fans of Diane Lane and young Diane Lane fans. Stephanie writes, The Ten Commandments. Yes, that's a television tradition. I get that. Although I don't think of it as an Easter movie, it's a biblical film. But it's the same mentality that, by their rationale, I'm, of course, talking to the networks. Apparently, The Wizard of Oz is a Thanksgiving movie, and It's a Wonderful Life is a Christmas film. It's not a Christmas film. It's a life-assuring film that just happens to be set at Christmas. And don't get me started on Die Hard. Pat writes Dungeons and Dragons as well as Air. Dustin writes The Homecoming, A Day in the Death of Joe Egg, Brokeback Mountain, and Michael Clayton. Daniel writes Radium Girls as well as Hereafter. David writes Spirited Away and X-Men First Class. JJ writes Race with the Devil, John Wick Chapter 4, Moonshine County Express, The Boston Strangler. That's the reboot. Oscar Michu, the superhero of black filmmaking. Thank you. Robert Muggy writes, Five by Eric Rahmer, Claire's Knee, A Tale of Springtime, A Tale of Winter, A Tale of Summer, and A Tale of Autumn. Plus, just upgraded to a 4K Blu-ray box of Kieslowski's, The Three Colors Trilogy, and watched Blue again. Abby writes Dungeons and Dragons. Eric writes, first time views A Man Called Otto. Anytime I see A Man Called Otto, I implore you to watch A Man Called Uwe. Clash of the Wolves, 1925. He writes, my first movie featuring silent era superstar Rin Tin Tin, not Wan Tun Tun, the dog that saved Hollywood. For love of movies, the story of American film criticism, and Damien Chazelle's tiresome, disappointing Babylon, which made my top 10 because it's such a hot mess. And for the rewatch, On the Waterfront, honoring the 99th anniversary of Marlon Brando's birth. Terry also chimes in, it seems that I enjoyed Babylon more than, well, pretty much everyone. That being said, I absolutely recognize that it's a flawed film and understand the prevailing criticism on that basis. Yeah, I'm with you, Terry. I think it's just decadent and too much, and it just made me giggle. So it's like, I think I've mentioned this, if you took Baz Luhrmann's The Great Gatsby and Night of the Locusts and just kind of put them in a blender and then serve it to Margot Robbie. Kevin writes, In Bruges. Kristen writes, I See You. Rachel writes, Return from Witch Mountain and Sherlock Holmes in Washington. Tom writes, Ben-Hur, The Battle of the River Plate, a.k.a. The Pursuit of the Graf Spee, and Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania. Thank you. Taylor writes Deadstream, All Quiet on the Western Front, and The Evil Dead from 2013. Chris writes Coda. Adam writes The Fablemans. Mason writes, watching a lot of Star Wars, mostly sticking to the main, quote-unquote, main nine movies, but gonna do Rogue One and Solo soon, too. I'm old enough. I think the main films are just the first three, because I'm old. Michael, no need to apologize, Michael, but I will write, sorry about this, but these are the movies I've watched since the last post, which obviously was some time ago. Michael, it happens. You've been busy on some several Thursday mornings when I asked for the titles on Facebook and Twitter. On the Beach, The Banshees of Inisherin, Top Gun Maverick, Detective Story, Tar, Black Panther Wakanda Forever, Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio, The Fugitive Kind, She Said, Charge of the Light Brigade, The Naked City, good choice. I watched that earlier this year. Man of the West, Fantastic Voyage, the original Village of the Damned, From Here to Eternity, Narvik, Lolita, Shotgun Wedding, The Fablemans, Triangle of Sadness, The Woman King, Doctor Strangelove, Women Talking, The Damned, Lady and the Tramp, Snow White, Oblivion, Hour of the Gun, The Big Lebowski, Dungeons and Dragons, Honor Among Thieves, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and Murder Mystery. All right, Michael, you are caught up. It's all good. Don't worry on that. That's fine. Taylor writes The Public Enemy, Maltese Falcon, the 1931 Maltese Falcon, I'll have you know. The Equalizer, Master and Commander, Brother Orchid, Birds of Prey, Kong Skull Island, and happy 100th birthday to Warner Brothers. And Dot. David writes Case 39, quite a slog. Mary writes Orpheus by Cocteau. Terry writes Road Games from 1981. Cassie writes Dogma. And finally, Adrian writes The Lost Boys and The Color Purple. And there you are, friends. That's what you've been watching this week. So hopefully you got to see some good movies that are new, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. Friends, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's some out there. Thanks again to Chris Lloyd for coming in studio to be a guest. I got to get back to some guests. I also know the phone line in the studio has changed its system, so I got to figure that out. But I'm trying to get out of my hermit shell a little bit, although I still love reading the titles for, that y'all watch. Anyway, thanks again to Chris Lloyd. Hopefully the Art Craft Theater in Franklin gets a speedy recovery. And drive in, and I think we're past the cold weather, so drive in season's really going to kick in. So there we go. We will try this again next week. Thank you for listening. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!